Welcome to Conversations with Leaders, an AWS podcast focused on personal lessons of leadership, culture, and technology from business leaders across the globe. Enjoy today's conversation.
I'm Clark Rogers, Director of Enterprise Strategy at AWS, and your guide for a series of conversations with AWS security leaders here on Executive Insights. Today, we're talking with Paul Vixie, AWS Deputy CISO, Vice President, and Distinguished Engineer. Paul brings a unique perspective to AWS security, having been an early influencer in the evolution of the internet. Join our conversation as we discuss the role of security leaders in making the internet a safer place to communicate. We hope you enjoy. Paul, thank you so much for joining me today. You've been in the internet game for quite some time. Can you sort of share some of your observations of, you know, how it started and how we got to where we are today, especially, you know, from a security perspective?
Well, security was an afterthought, so that comes into the story considerably later. The stories are true. This did begin as a U.S. government network. It was never used by the military, at least in the early days, and so there's a mythos that the protocols were designed to be hardened against, you know, kinetic attacks or, you know, whatever. That's not true. It's always been a best effort system, and, you know, when it works really well for a lot of people. When it doesn't work, there can be some catastrophic failures that a more hardened network would not have.
At what point did you realize, oops, security wasn't taken into account, and what did you realize needed to happen?
So I started ringing the alarm bells pretty early, and my initial concern was spam. We had no authentication, nothing that prevented people from sending unwanted traffic, because in a pure government network, you didn't have anybody who would benefit from sending unwanted traffic. So I started ringing the alarm bells as early as 92. And after I was off on my own doing consulting and so forth, I also started the first anti-spam project, which became the first anti-spam company. And our distributed reputation system was the first of its kind. Wish I'd patented that. That system is still in broad use today, although the company I started to fight spam got sued out of existence. So that company is gone, but the idea and the technologies all live on. And boy, was I ever right.
So what, if anything, and I hope there's something, is sort of encouraging you now that you're seeing security being taken more seriously, not only at the large cloud service providers, but at customer companies as well? Does it give you hope?
I have hope, and it's tinged with disappointment, because everything we're doing is too little too late. But you kind of have to wait for the whole market to wake up and see the problem. You can't just be ringing the alarm bell as one company or one person. So one thing that gives me hope is a collection of technologies that I've encountered after coming to Amazon. It turns out that at scale, there are some problems that you can generalize and solutions that you can then deploy, which can't be done by smaller companies who are only doing a small thing. So as an example, what we've done in the Graviton processors to make our VMs more secure against other VMs.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's done that except us. If you look at the Nitro chipset and the Nitro hypervisor, nobody's done that except us. When Log4j came out, as an example, we weren't unaffected, but we had a patch for all of our customers, you know, within a few dozens of hours, because we're big enough to know how to do it and to be able to deploy it rapidly in a global way. Whereas a less centralized system where everybody's responsible for their own stuff, yeah, you got to wait for your supply chain to wake up. So I'm hopeful simply because as this thing, this internet thing, became critical infrastructure and became kind of the global digital nervous system and the source of the world's economy, people started taking it more seriously. And a lot of the things we did early on a shoestring back when transistors cost $1 a piece are gradually phasing out. And other than by not doing the stupid things in the first place that helped us get to market faster than the OSI protocols, there's no other way to fix this except with clouds like ours.
Please tell me a little bit about your role here at AWS.
I was hired as a Vice President Distinguished Engineer. That is a very small group of very sort of experienced people. So that role is very much self-directed. To be a Vice President Distinguished Engineer, your job description is to find trouble and get into it. It's very rare that anybody says, Paul, we really need you to do a certain thing.
Right.
And so that's a huge honor in a company of this size to be set loose, especially coming in 25 years after the fact and not knowing how we got here. So that's been huge. I was appointed the deputy CISO for AWS and coincidentally asked to lead the office of the CISO. And you can think of the office of the CISO as C-level solution architects, right? If there is a conversation with the customer where somebody from their C-level is going to be present, normally we want to put our CISO in that room.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble is we only have one CISO. We have a lot of rooms. And so we are kind of the backup band for the CISO. And so that's half dozen people that are absolutely at the top of the field, top of their game. And I had been working with them. In fact, I embedded with them in order to get contact with customers. And that's, I think, why I was tapped to lead that team.
Was there anything that really drew you to AWS?
It was the description of the job. In other words, if I had been asked to come here and be the VP of one thing or another and be in charge of a certain function, I would have said, yeah, I've been there, done that. But this is primarily a technology position, at least the distinguished engineer part of my job is basically an executive level individual contributor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to understand why that was exciting, the last time I had the word engineer in my title was also the last time someone other than me wrote me an offer letter. And that ended in 1993. So to be able to get back on the original track that I would have been on without all those startups, and to just be an individual contributing engineer was flattering. Once they described the position, it kind of sat in the back of my brain and chittered at me and said, yeah, you really want to get back to that.
So you've been here for a while now. You've been able to sort of poke around. What have been your impressions of specifically the security culture at AWS?
So in my various startup companies, I sold to companies like this one. Corporate governance is pretty much the same everywhere, except that here the security team has been here so long that we make a justifiable claim that security is job zero. And that's not just a claim. It's reflected all the way up and down the org chart, up and down the operating plans, up and down the budget priorities. In other words, we, of course, we're here to deliver for customers, like hopefully any company is there for their customers. The difference is we will not do something for our customers that also leads them to be insecure. We never leave the security out. That is what's different here.
We hope you're enjoying this discussion. To engage with other business leaders on these topics, follow us on LinkedIn at AWS Executive Insights. Now, back to our conversation.
As we sort of look forward into the next couple of years, are there any particular technologies or methodologies that you're particularly excited about that you think is going to help not only companies like ours, but also our customers to move forward with their, you know, sort of security and compliance workloads?
Well, certainly one thing that's heartening internally is the way that containers are turning out. You know, the fact that we can have, you know, 10,000 of these all operating on a single chip,
right,
and start thousands of them per second if there's a load spike, but not require somebody to completely change the way they did their software engineering. That is heartening because as people move to that model, we will get away from the problem we have now on, for example, patching. On any given day, there's something that needs to be patched. And unless you have a team dedicated to that, you're going to put it off. You're going to do it once a week, once a month, whatever. And when you do that, you may find, gee, in order to make this patch fit the system I have, I've also got to upgrade these other things, which means I have to put the whole thing in a test lab.
Yep.
And so you could be months away from the time that you find that something really desperately needs patching to the time when you finally have that patch in your system. I don't think we can get to the glorious future in Star Trek where everything just works if we keep doing that. And so things like containers, whether it be Lambda, Kubernetes, Firecracker, gives you a chance to sort of have your build pipeline, the so-called CI/CD, you know, make an image and run it through its tests. And if it passes, you can just drop it into service. So the idea that we're going to stop having humans in the loop is the other heartening thing. You know, I'm sad to say this because humans thought this up and humans built it, but we have to reduce the human element now if we want to have safety that is not reducing over time. The amount of software and hardware that is sort of between a human and the value delivered to a customer is greater than it's ever been. And our understanding has remained relatively fixed, which is to say we understand a smaller fraction of it every time it grows. That won't work. We're going to have to figure out how to make sure that the complexity doesn't create outcomes that are undesirable. And again, that depends on having more discipline and keeping humans out of the loop.
With the idea around human access and networks, you know, the idea of zero trust has evolved over the years.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on zero trust, both from an AWS perspective, like how we think about things and implement things internally, but also from a customer perspective? How should they be looking at zero trust?
The key irreducible element of zero trust is misunderstood. For example, I've heard people talking about this who say, just put everything online, make it all reachable, and secure the services and the servers themselves, secure the network without having a perimeter. That's not the point of zero trust and doesn't work, right? You know, you still need a firewall. It's just that once you're inside the firewall, you won't find that you have any special trust just because you're inside the perimeter. So it's doing away with the assumption that reachability implies trustworthiness. It used to be called the crunchy exterior and the soft GUI interior. So we don't want to have a soft GUI interior, even though we still have a crunchy exterior. So you need a system that mechanizes identity and authentication and permissions at scale. And, you know, as an example, while you and I are having this conversation, there are a couple of billion of authentication events per second happening on the Amazon cloud. And we didn't use any sort of cheap tricks like caching recent results and saying, well, if you had permission a second ago, you probably still have permission. No, we check every time. And, you know, at some point we bit the bullet and said, nothing less than that is going to properly address security as job zero. But again, most systems were designed with the idea that if you could get in, then you, since they didn't have fine-grained access control that would work at scale,
right,
they just let you do anything you wanted. That's what we're changing. There are a number of different authentication standards. Ours has gotten out there kind of first, and it's very big, but it's, you know, was never meant to be an industry standard, and so other clouds have similar things that they're working on. And there are some industry standards that are trying to get born, and as far as I know, without having talked to the service team, we're going to make sure that any customer who wants to operate that way can do so.
In the last year or so, generative AI has been all over the news and seems to appear almost daily in my news feed. What are your thoughts on it from a security practitioner perspective? How do you see security professionals using it to help protect, investigate, those types of things?
So you have to look past the hype and say, what will it be once it settles down? And in some cases, we don't know. It's a pretty new technology, and a lot of hardware and software is being crafted for it. And you never really know what the impact of a tool is going to be until it is used by somebody other than its maker.
Sure.
And, you know, if you're going to use a wrench as a hammer, that's probably not what the wrench maker thought you were going to do, but it might work in some situations. It might even work better than the hammer for some situations. We haven't seen strong indications of what this will really make possible once the hype cycle dies down and, you know, we have something else that's grabbing the headlines. That having been said, we at Amazon have been doing research, development, and deployment of AI-based solutions for at least the last dozen years. And so this was not a complete surprise to us. We already have an example in that the Code Whisperer system of something that is using generative AI techniques but doesn't look anything like what's been grabbing the headlines. I see that happening on all sorts of systems. For example, when you're doing anomaly detection, you're looking at telemetry flows from your system, you're looking at either events that indicate maybe there's something going wrong or events that may indicate somebody's attacking you. It's going to be possible to cross-correlate those better now that we have this technology. And again, I feel like we've barely seen 1% of what will be possible. So while on the one hand, I despise the hype cycle and I wish we could just be serious from the get-go,
right?
I also understand there is some real merit here. I'm working with some teams inside of AWS Security who are trying to answer that exact question. What can we do to better serve our customers now that this is generally available and generally understood?
Right. And then sort of help that security, that human security practitioner with maybe a lot of the grunt work from a technology perspective with generative AI tooling.
Yes. And, you know, I don't mean this to be a product plug, but you know, Amazon's biggest success with our cloud has always been the workflows we enable our customers to adopt and build. And so one of the first things that we did in the large language model space was Bedrock. The idea is, if you want to use a large language model, do you also want to pay the training costs? Do you want to have to build the model? Because that can take thousands of hours or tens of thousands of hours of very expensive computer time to do. And if there are various pre-built models and they're sort of on a menu and you get to pick which ones you want, but you don't have to pay to copy that to your own system, you can simply put logic in your VPC or, you know, whatever it is you're doing in our cloud environment that has direct access to APIs that know that they have access to these subscription models. And so the original premise, which I didn't know at the time, I've had to learn after coming here, the premise of the cloud turned out to be that having an elastic amount of compute, so as much as you really needed, next to an elastic amount of storage, again, as much as you really needed, with no access penalty, is how we got big. And now we've just replicated that inside of Gen AI, so that people who are maybe very ambitious in their own segment of the market can do with our cloud and LLMs what they've always done with our cloud without LLMs. We love that. I love that. Because the real power of this will turn out to be what our customers did with it.
Yeah. And then that the customers have that built-in trust from all the security tooling that they've used for years and other aspects, they can now apply that to tools like Bedrock and whatever else may be coming down the road. So let's switch to your other day job, which, you know, running the office of the CISO. You have a lot of exposure to our customers and you interact with them throughout the world, either in person or in virtual. One of the vehicles that you've participated in at AWS is the AWS CISO Circles. Could you share a little bit about that and your experience with it?
My introduction to CISO Circles was Chief Paul, could you go to, it was Madrid in this case, and participate in a CISO Circles? And I went, and it was terrific because what we had was a bunch of CISOs from a particular industry who had come together. And the whole thing is under a bit of an NDA. You're expected to be able to speak freely because the other people in the room are not going to repeat what you've said.
Chatham House rule.
Chatham House rules. And these are, in some cases, competitors, right? They're CISOs of companies that are in the same industry, maybe, or in the same region. And they wouldn't normally share ideas or share experiences. But because they were in our house and we were there and we were kind of moderating the discussion and seeding the discussion with some presentations about various bits of technology, and then encouraging discussion, encouraging challenges, encouraging ultimately what turned out to be an argument among themselves,
right.
it was beautiful to see. Because that's one of the things that any mid to large company has got to be able to do is to benefit from the experiences of their competitors. And we should not be trying to compete based on who is more secure. Because, you know, if you and I are in the same industry and you get popped,
right,
that still hurts me. And it probably means I'm next.
Right.
So we need to stand shoulder to shoulder in some areas, even while competing in others. And they ended up getting to know each other, figuring out how much trust they could extend without risking, you know, their company secrets and so forth. And the intent is that they stay in touch with each other after the event. And, of course, inevitably that means somebody will say, oh, well, I had this terrible experience with some API in the cloud that day, and somebody else will say, well, it works for me. And, you know, if they end up complaining to each other about us, well, you know, if we have it coming, then we should embrace that too, because we're not going to be able to get better at serving our customers if we don't know what's going wrong. So it turns out to be a huge source of business intelligence for us. Oh, I wish I had.
Right.
And sometimes you get to say, actually, that exists. We're a very big company and we innovate a lot and we do create new features or new technologies at a rate that no customer could keep up with. I mean, it's my job to do so and I have a hard time keeping up with it. So we have to have that customer interface where somebody knows what the customer's problems are and what the industry's problems are and what they're doing, how they're doing it, what their pain points are. Turns out we have people that are doing that that the customers don't know they should be making time to meet with on a regular basis. And if the CISO circle helps that happen, onesie-twosie, I hope it then spreads by word of mouth and becomes a movement.
Fantastic. Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining me today.
It has been great. Thanks again for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Conversations with Leaders, brought to you by AWS Executive Insights. For more on these topics, visit aws.amazon.com/executive insights. While there, visit our generative AI and ML page for more resources to help you unlock the value of generative AI for your business.